I know that he's a good, decent American, but Bat Segundo is no more. Welcome to Uncle Don's Cabin, the show that dares to tell the truth about the racial divide in this country. I know I got into trouble for a comment I made on another program. Well, let me explain. By nappy-haired hoes, I was not referring to African Americans, who I love from the bottom of my heart. Although I understand they're all well hung. I was referring to the American practice of covering a hole with a napkin. For example, let's say you've got one of those sluts going down on you while you're eating a nice steak dinner in a restaurant. Your cock's poking out of your jeans and you don't want the waiter to catch on. So you throw your napkin over the hole and voila! Nappy-haired hoe. Well, that's what I was talking about. Anyway, we'll have some calls in a moment, but first, an interview with a fellow named William T. Volman. I don't read too much, but I understand Volman's a good point guard on the court.
Okay, so I'm here with William Volman, yet again. He's here for the book Poor People, and he's the author of many other books. Bill, how are you doing?
So far, so good. Thanks, Ed.
First of all, I wanted to actually ask about the sort of collective nature of Poor People. In many ways, it's kind of a nonfiction counterpart to The Atlas. And I'm wondering if this was kind of a way for you to sort of go back through your journeys over the last several years and kind of reconfigure them using this theme of poverty. Is this kind of what it served, or were there any parallels between this and The Atlas?
Well, some of the writing that I did for both took place in the same time and place, but much of it did not. And The Atlas is a string of stories related through thematic patterns. And some of them are true, most of them are not. This is a simpler project in a way. It's just an attempt to understand a certain kind of reality.
Well, I know also that you have the dimensions of poverty in this book, which reminded me very much of the moral compass. I'm wondering if you need some sort of structural axis along these lines with which to take on a big theme like violence or poverty. Is this a way for you to recontextualize it? Or?
Well, I thought that that I would have to treat poverty the way I did treat violence. But then I began to see that violence is active. Violence involves doing something, whereas poverty is more of a passive state of being. And so it's not as if it has justifications or even, from the point of view of the poor person, even necessarily causes. So you can't really ask somebody, why are you engaged in the act of being poor, and is it justified or not? You can mainly just ask them, well, why are you in this state of being? What's the story of how it happened to you? And so, in many ways, it's a narrower sort of compass.
And yet you also have the photographic element. I wanted to ask you about that because you shot the photos yourself. Did you feel that you needed to shoot these photographs in order to actually understand that you were the only person qualified for this, as opposed to, say, another photographer? Or?
Well, usually I was the only person there with my subject, aside often from an interpreter.
Yeah.
And I think the photographs are the most important part of the book. And the text is just sort of a series of extended captions.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And can I put this on the room? Would that be okay?
Yeah, what room number?
339.
And last name?
V-O-L-L-M-A-N-N.
V-O-L-L.
M-A-N-N. If you bring it, I can sign it so I can give you a tip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to these photographs, essentially they sort of speak 1,000 words to a certain degree.
So we hope.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you bring up I.A. Richards' famous experiment in poetry, in which he basically gave unidentifiable poetry to students, and he basically said, I see no reason whatsoever to think that a higher standard of critical discernment can easily be found under our present cultural conditions.
What do you think of that?
Well, I actually agree with him, but the question is whether this particular observation can be applied to poverty. Certainly it can, but the book proposes no particular solution. So I'm wondering, what are really, in our current times, is the way to kind of shift cultural conditions to get people to sort of recognize this? Or does this...
Thank you.
Or does this book serve that particular purpose, to at least get the ball rolling?
Well, I think that one of the mistakes that we have made with so many problems, including drugs, poverty, illegal immigration, sexual conduct that we don't agree with, is that there is a technocratic solution, or even a one-size-fits-all solution. Alcohol is clearly bad, it's addictive, it's dangerous. Fine, let's prohibit alcohol. Well, that didn't work so well. And of course, it didn't stop people from doing exactly the same thing with drugs. And we're just beginning to sense that maybe that's not going to work so well either. It's not working so well with immigration. And we haven't made a lot of progress with poverty either. And one of the reasons is that people talk about some kind of objective solution. You throw a certain amount of money at the problem. If people are in bad housing projects, let's tear them down and put them into new housing projects. Maybe some of those things might have useful effects, maybe not, but they'll only go a certain degree in addressing the problem, because poverty is a state of being. It's the way somebody feels. And if somebody feels that he doesn't have enough, maybe he has enough to eat, enough to sleep on, whatever, but he has so much less than the people around him that he feels humiliation and rage, and yet he's above the minimal monetary standard for poverty, let's say, then what solution do we have for him? So it's a problem like so many of these social problems that involve communication skills, and particularly require the ability to listen and individualize on the part of the prospective benefactor. And that's something that we're not good at.
Well, you also quibble with the UN motto, more aid, better directed, sort of sarcastically sort of saying, hey, that, couldn't we all use some of that?
Exactly, yeah, what a great idea, but...
But I guess what I'm saying, though, isn't that a starting point, though, towards at least recognizing poverty, even though there is this great chasm, as you describe, between poverty as it exists and poverty as it is identified by some sort of global organization or a group of elitist intellectuals sitting comfortably at a villa somewhere, you know?
Right. Well, there are two aspects to the solution of poverty. One is, what should we, as a society or as the human race, do about it? And the other question is, what should you or I do about it, whether or not the human race gets its act together? And it would be very easy to say, well, since our country is not going to send these people more aid, better directed, therefore, it's an insoluble problem and I don't need to worry about it.
I wanted to actually talk also about Suni, who is the character, or that not just the cat, the character, but the real person in Thailand, who you keep coming back to in the book. What was it about her irony that was the starting point or the constant comparison point? Because you use her in a lot of contexts of this book.
In part, it was her idea that she had been bad in a previous life. And therefore, she needed to accept her destiny of being poor. And to me, that's a very strange and interesting thing to wrap my head around. You know, it sounds terrible in a way to believe that you are responsible for your own misfortune, not the kind of thing that you or I in this country of individuals and supposed opportunity would want to believe. If someone tried to tell us that, we'd probably think, oh, you just want us to believe that so that you can keep the resources and not give them to us.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if those resources are not there, and if she genuinely does have no other opportunities, so that the only thing she has to look forward to in her life is being drunk, then maybe that really is an okay way for her to cope with being poor, to say, I'm going to accept it for the rest of my life. Here's the deal, and here's the way that I make meaning out of it.
Well, there's two aspects to Sunni that are interesting. One, the translator identifies that, well, hey, she has a fridge and a TV, so she can't necessarily be poor. So
her mother does, yeah.
Yeah, her mother does, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And so there's this relative notion. You mentioned that absolute and relative meanings of poverty are very important to consider. But there's also what you point out later in the book, where if an agricultural industry had existed to help Sunni, she may not have spent her evenings drinking herself into this sort of oblivion, or, you know.
Right.
But simultaneously, who's to say, what about her psychological makeup? What, maybe she's inclined, maybe as an individual, to sort of really sort of gravitate towards alcohol.
Is it
fair to sort of say that you can actually have a solution to poverty by just changing the circumstances, when in fact, maybe on an individual psychological level, she's maybe has some problems that she needs treatment?
Or maybe she doesn't have problems. Maybe it's the best way that she can be. Yeah. But we can talk about Sunni as Sunni, or we can talk about Sunni as a member of the underclass.
Or we can talk about Sunni as a human being.
That is true.
Yeah.
And I think that we risk defeating ourselves when we start confusing these various categories. So if you decided to make Sunni your case, your charity case, let's say, you might approach her in one particular way. If you decided to consider her as an example of something and a problem that you really did want to actively address, but she was going to be one of the many recipients of your generosity, you might approach her in a different way.
So really you're saying basically it's all in the kind of intellectual context or the experiential context with which you actually approach, in this hypothetical situation, Sunni.
That's right. I mean, I could have said, oh, I feel so sorry for Sunni, so I'm going to go and give a lot of money to an NGO that works in Thailand and specializes in people who make sub-minimum income. Or I could have said, I'm going to give Sunni and her daughter as much money as I can that doesn't seem like it's going to get them in trouble. And that's the approach that I took. And I can't say that one approach was better or worse than the other approach.
I want to also tie this into your experience in Kazakhstan, where you pointed out this really terrible predicament, invisible to most Americans, of these people who were breathing in these sulfurous fumes, all because an oil company needs to drill the location. And how Americans live in this kind of comfort and that there's this great sort of geographical disparity. I'm wondering if you can sort of describe how this touches in to not just poverty, but also this kind of idea of reacting. Certainly an American who is, you know, needs to get to work or needs to essentially, like, you know, get about their regular day, needs a car to operate. Are they then, you know, it's sort of shifting levels of guilt here. One should be aware, certainly, of this Kazakhstan business, but at the same time, how does this tie in, how does this relate to finding awareness within the kind of everyday existence that Western countries and the like enjoy?
That's right. We all have choices and we all have obligations. And I don't think it's too much to ask of other people that they try to make ethical choices when they can in certain areas. I think, unfortunately, it is too much to ask of people that they make ethical and informed choices in all areas of their lives, because most people don't have the leisure and the resources to make those choices. So I never would have seen that particular problem if I hadn't had the leisure and the resources to spend 3 or 4 weeks in Kazakhstan. You know, since I saw it, of course I'm haunted by it. If I, let's say, if I were married to someone, I lived in the suburbs, my wife and I each had a car, we each had a long drive, we had a mortgage, we had kids, the house was not gaining value, and the idea of moving closer to one job to save gas, or maybe be farther from the other job, and so on and so forth, it's probably asking too much for us to do anything about this problem in which we are involuntarily complicit. However, I do think that our elected representatives, who have the leisure and money and the obligation to study this problem, could have done much better in the past and ought to do better in the future.
In the end of the book, you write a chapter that in which you describe your own dealings as, in your view, a petty bourgeois property owner.
That's me.
Yes. with vagrants in your neighborhood. And this struck me on a number of levels. In fact, it was probably my favorite part of the book, simply because you very rarely, I guess, open yourself up in the first-person singular like this. You've relied in your fiction and to some of your nonfiction in this sort of first-person plural voice, the rather sort of you and a kind of alter ego, an alter ego narrator guiding the reader along into a very unpleasant territory. So I'm wondering, and then on top of this, you have this very sort of confessional stance. So I'm wondering, A, what provoked this particular section? Did you feel that you had to lay your cards right on the line so that you can say, hey, this is poverty, and I'm willing to go ahead and put my own sort of flaws on the line, showing that I'm very much like one of you, because later on you also ask, reader, who are you as well? And then also going to this voice that you don't usually use, I'm wondering if you could kind of just talk about both of these.
That's right. Well, I think it's my obligation to the reader to show where I stand. And poverty is a very unpleasant topic. It tends to make those of us who are rich enough to have the leisure to buy and read a book like this guilty and anxious. And even though I try not to ask people to do too much, I'm still saying, well, this is the problem and this concerns me, and maybe in some way some of us could do this or that. So if I'm going to do any of that, I can't be a hypocrite. I have to talk about my own efforts and my own failings. And at the same time, I don't want the book to be too much about me, because it's supposed to be about them. I try to keep myself out of it where I can. But at some point, it seems like it would be an evasion of responsibility if I didn't describe my own dealings with poor people on a day-to-day level. I mean, they have to live it on a day-to-day level. And it's easy enough for me to go to Thailand and say, oh, you know, poor Sunni, and then go to Kazakhstan and say, oh, these poor people. Well, suppose those poor people in Kazakhstan all lived in my parking lot and their needs were endless and I was there every day, then what would I do about it?
Yeah.
So I think it's important to be honest and sincere about, you know, what little I've been able to do and the vast amount that I've been unable to do. And that is the result of being a member of my class, a rich person.
Well, reader, who are you? That sort of suggests to me that you're just as equally baffled about of the people who read you as I suppose people who say, ah, Volman, he's just that cult writer. Oh, he happened to win the National Book Award, but never mind that. I mean, are you genuinely sort of puzzled by someone who would want to read a book on poverty? Or
I think that we should all ask ourselves who we are. And in any important social topic, such as poverty, what does who we are mean to us? What sort of actions are we inclined to take? Do we feel satisfied with inaction, which is not necessarily the wrong thing? Are we poor? Are we rich? What battles do we want to fight? I think that that's something that it's helpful for all of us to ask ourselves much of the time. It's good for us to do it.
But are you asking yourself sort of, I guess, who you are in these journeys and this constant sort of writing? Or?
Sure I am. You know, I think I was able to see fairly clearly in the book what some of these people's problems were. And unfortunately for my ego, you know, when I write about myself and my parking lot and so forth, I can see just as clearly what my own failures are in trying to really address the problem. And I think that if we're all honest about our failures and we say, in spite of our failures, here's the little that we can do, and if we did it, it's actually not going to harm us that much and it might even benefit us, then I would say we're a little bit more ahead and poor people are a little bit more ahead.
So the issue then, perhaps the solution to recognizing poverty or at least perhaps responding to it, to actually not just have these more aid better directed, is just to live a life of total honesty and transparency, essentially.
And of course, if you can provide other people with more aid better directed, why not? And if you are more honest, then you know how much more aid you can and want to direct to whom.
I wanted to actually ask you about you paying your interview subjects when you talk with them.
Okay.
You note in the footnote, yes, I paid them. And recently, Kurt Eichenwald, he got into trouble with the New York Times because he paid $2,000 to this subject for this really sensational child pornography story that appeared in the New York Times magazine. And I'm wondering, is money necessary when talking with poor people? I mean, we don't have any record, at least to my knowledge, that James Agee and Walker Evans actually paid out money to talk to these various people. Do you feel that money is both, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this technique? And do you feel that it's sufficiently honest to, you know, as so long as you say, hey, I'm paying all these interview subjects so they can talk with me?
Well, firstly, and most importantly, it's kind. And if you're writing about people who don't have anything and they're going to give you knowledge, and especially if that knowledge might make you money, then I think that you would be very cruel and selfish not to pay them. Secondly, I would say that to the extent that you can make it an equal transaction, you are giving them dignity, and you are also acknowledging your own obligation. Sometimes if I give somebody a quarter in the street, it's not a completely comfortable exchange. The person feels a little bit ashamed for begging and feels that he is, you know, maybe taking advantage of me, and he wants to justify himself and say, oh, I'm not going to use this to, you know, to smoke crack or whatever, when I couldn't care less what he does with it.
Yeah.
But he feels bad. Whereas if someone tells me about his life and I pay him, then, you know, we both know that he has earned his money fair and square. And if he wants to use it to smoke crack, why not? I guess the main worry for a journalist is if somehow the giving or receiving of money will distort what is being said. And obviously, if I were going to interview some politician and he gave me, a check for $100,000 right before the interview, and I cashed it, there would be some concern if I said glowing things about him, that I said so because of the money. On the other hand, if I am paying somebody else, in a way, I think that makes me all the more free. I don't have to think, well, this person was doing me a favor, and therefore, you know, I'd better be incredibly flattering. I can think, okay, sometimes I give people bad reviews in the New York Times.
Yes, most recently you got into trouble with that.
Yeah, and sometimes I get bad reviews in the New York Times. And, you know, I'm a big boy. They're big boys. It's all fine, you know. That's part of the deal. And if someone tells me about his life, and I pay him money and write about it, and he doesn't really like what I've said, if that's how it turned out to be, that's okay. You know, we're all adults, and we're all in this business together. So I think it keeps everybody honest and fair.
But some would argue that this is, there's a certain sense of corruptibility in what a person would tell you if you were to go ahead and give them, like, say, $100 to talk with you.
Well, I think the main worry is that you could call it the Scheherazade effect.
Yeah.
You know, she wants to keep on telling the story so she's not going to get her head chopped off.
Yeah.
And if somebody thought that she could keep me coming back and keep me paying her, then maybe she would tailor her story accordingly. But most of them have no expectation of that at the beginning. They don't know whether they'll ever see me again. And if they do, I think that's relatively trivial. I can't see that that any harm is being done by paying people for information. And as far as I can see, a great deal of good is being done. And I can look myself in the face and know that I've not only not exploited my subjects, but I've helped them. So I think it's a good thing.
Okay. I have tons of questions, but I guess we'll have to wait until another time. Bill,
I guess
it's a pleasure chatting with you again.
Yeah, you too, Ed.
All right. Thank you.